What a joy it is to be in the house of the Lord. Y'all got to help me through this today. If you don't know me, I'm Lee Montgomery. I've been coming here for a long time, probably over 20 years. I got deaconized back in 1997, I believe it was, serving on about my third term, maybe fourth. And my wife is up here to help me out today because I know I'm going to get emotional, so if you just forgive me for that and overlook that, I don't think that's bad. And today I'm going to talk about the lessons I've learned and relearned in times of adversity. Now, there's a lot of different types of adversity. What I went through recently was cancer. It's a scary thing when a doctor says, you know, you got cancer. It's one of those things you think it's supposed to happen to somebody else. It's not supposed to happen to me, but nobody's exempt. I've gotten through the cancer pretty well, all the treatment. I've been cancer-free. They first told me back in the spring, so far so good. The main after effects, I'm pretty well back to normal, except I have a little bit of numbness in my feet, and as the day goes on, my voice gets worse. But they assure me that this will go away eventually. It may take a while, but I'll try to get through this. But anyway, my wife has a lot more words than I do, so if I foul up, she'll take over for me. When I first became a deacon, they said, I hope you realize that you got to take your turn, but every 12 weeks you got to go out and pray. I said, man, I didn't know I was going to have to do this. So I fumbled through it a couple times. Every time I got up here, I got tongue-tied and forgot what I was going to say. So I got the bright idea. I said, well, maybe I'll just write this down. So I wrote it down on an index card, stuck it in my pocket, came up here, read it, held it down like this so nobody would see. They were my own words, but it just helped me get through it. So after I did this 3 or 4 times, we were coming out the door one morning, and Janet said, you know, you're the deacon of the week this week. You got to go pray. I said, oh, I didn't know that. And she said, have you got your prayer in your pocket? She's pretty smart. It's hard to pull anything over on her. But anyway, I've known a lot of people that have gone through serious problems. There are people in this church that have gone through a lot worse than I have. If you know Trooper Jim Porter, he's had heart problems, eventually got a heart transplant. And I know he's suffered a lot over the years. I think he's doing a lot better. And as I look around, I see a lot of other people that have been affected by tragic events also. I mean, when you lose a parent, that's a definite adversity. If you lose anybody close in your family, that really does something to you. One of my brothers, and one of my sisters, have had children killed in car wrecks. Just for a minute.
Well, Lee's going to talk today about the lessons that he learned from his walk through the valley of cancer, we can call it. And I want to share a couple of verses of scripture with you that mean a lot to me. And I think when he was first diagnosed, it made it easier to think about this verse or these verses. It comes from Jeremiah 29:11-13. And when someone close to you has a very serious illness or gets hurt or whatever, as he's talking about adversity, We always say, why me? Why me? Why is this happening to me? And you have to stop and think that we're all part of God's plan. So this is what he says about that. For I know the plans I have for you. That means each one of us. He has a specific plan for our lives. Says the Lord, they're plans for good and not for disaster, to give you a future and a hope. In those days when you pray, I will listen. If you look for me wholeheartedly, you will find me. And what other assurance could be better than that? To know that he's where we can find him if we just look. But Lee's going to talk to you about a few lessons, and I had a few that I wanted to mention as well. One of the first lessons that this illness and all of the things that go with it brought us to was humility. You know, we're Americans. We're brought up to be self-assured, and we can do anything. You know, we teach our kids, step out there. You can go to school, you can learn this, you can get any job, whether you're a girl or a boy or whether you speak Chinese or Japanese or whatever it is. We believe that as Americans and as people in this century, we have the ability to do whatever needs to be done to get where we want to go. Well, let me tell you, when you get a diagnosis of cancer, you don't have anything to do with it. You can do what the doctors tell you. You can follow advice. But when it comes right down to it, you're not in charge anymore. God is. And when we have to quit being so independent and allow others to help us, whether it be friends, church family, whatever it is, doctors. You have to trust in God. And, you know, it's easy to say that, but hard to do. But like I said, we couldn't do anything about this. This was something we had no control over. And I'm going to quote my son-in-law on this. He talked to me about, he said, you know, I've had a lot of windshield time lately. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, when you're in the car, you get a lot of time to think. And Lee and I spent a lot of windshield time this year together in the car. And we spent a lot of time talking and sharing serious, deep things. If your family is like mine, we spend so much time spinning our wheels and going and coming that a lot of times you don't really have that deep conversation, that time to share your hopes and your faith and your beliefs and all of those kinds of things. We talk about what we're going to have for dinner and where we have to go next week and how many payments you got left on the car. We talk about all that kind of thing, but the stuff we really ought to be talking about, we don't have time for that. So we had a lot of windshield time to talk about some real serious things and the things that we believe and the things that we hold dear. You hear people say, stop and smell the roses. Well, that's a cliche, but let me just say, slow down. Take time to enjoy the parts of life that you're involved in. We go so fast, and all of a sudden we're at the end of our lives, and we haven't taken the time to really enjoy anything. And the last thing I'm going to share is that if you have a loved one, or someone that you work with, or someone that you share a home with, it's time to overlook the little things that they do that annoy you. I have an electric toothbrush. Lee hates the sound of that electric toothbrush. He says, can't you just brush your teeth like normal people? But I like my electric toothbrush. It's the pitch of it that drives him crazy. He can be in a dead sleep, and when I brush my teeth, it comes straight up out of the bed. My point is that we need to ignore those things and focus on the big picture. Don't let the small annoyances of life take the joy away from you. And all I can say is that we have learned a lot in the last year, and I hope that he's going to be able now to share some more things with you.
All right, I got you. By the way, I'll try to do better now. But I heard a quote on radio one time. It went sort of like this. It says, today's test can be tomorrow's testimony. So testimony I'm given today is a result of yesterday's test. But anyway, the last thing I'd want to do is come up here and talk in front of all these people. It's just not my nature. But the Lord told me to do it, so here I am. I hope He'll give me some words to say that might be an inspiration to someone. So I was everything was going along pretty smoothly. Like I say, I've been coming here for a long time. But I have to admit this. Over the years, maybe I'd lost some of my focus. I spent a lot of time here, but lots of times I'd come in, my heart wouldn't be in it. My body would be here, but maybe I wasn't paying attention like I should. I just didn't get out of it what I used to. Like I say, I was here all the time, came to Sunday school, church, worked on a lot of different teams and ministries here at church, but I had sort of lost my focus. I love football, and I love photography. I've been a photographer for 40-some years, and I remember last spring, I got psyched up about a new camera that was going to come out. Every day on the computer, reading the details, oh, it's going to come out in the summer. No, it's going to be in the fall. Blah, blah, blah. Even when I was sitting in church, I was thinking about that. And, you know, I love the Hokies. Reading about all the recruiting stuff, about who we'll get next year, how good the team's going to be, all that kind of stuff. Even when I was sitting in church, I thought, let my mind wander. Thought about stuff like that. It was really probably pretty insignificant. So maybe, I mean, I don't think I did anything wrong or anything really bad. But this adversity has got me to rethinking. It's sort of like it slapped me upside the head. Said, you know, maybe I better get back to where I'm supposed to be. So I spent a lot more time praying this fall after I was diagnosed. I spent a lot of time on my knees. I got really, really close to the Lord. I could feel Him in the room as I communicated with Him. It was such a closeness that I'd never experienced before. I couldn't sleep anyway. I didn't want to come to bed, toss and turn, wake Janet up. So I spent a lot of time. I read the Bible. And I did a lot of praying. And some of the things you read in the Bible, you have a hard time understanding and a hard time believing. But something happened one night that I got to tell you about. You can believe it or just write it off. But an angel actually appeared to me. Now, this was sort of a strange angel. For one thing, he was wearing casual clothes. He didn't have a white robe on or anything like that. No sandals, regular shoes. And this angel was wearing sunglasses. And that's what I saw. When I first saw him, he was about as far away from here to the third pew. Started walking toward me. I looked at him. To me, it was someone that I felt very close to. I didn't know his name. It was hard to see his eyes, but as he got closer to me, I could start to see his eyes, and as we looked at each other, he gave me the most beautiful smile I've seen in my life. It's a blessing when you see one of your children smile at you, especially a newborn baby, and she smiles at you for the first time. That's a real blessing. But the smile from this angel, and by the way, his skin was glowing. Maybe that's why he had to have the sunglasses. Maybe I needed some. I don't know. But anyway, the angel, as he approached, he got, it was like he was my best friend. And he stopped about as far as from here to the front pew, held out his arms like this, and raised them. I remember thinking to myself, what does this mean? Does it mean I'm ready to go to heaven? I really had no doubt that's where I would go if this was the end. And I was in a lot of discomfort, and it wouldn't have mattered to me if I'd have left the earth right then. And I thought, you know, I sure would miss my kids, but I think what he was really saying is to get up, let's get this done, let's get this taken care of. So it must have been the second choice instead of the first one, because here I am to talk about it. This is not easy. But for me, when I had the cancer, instead of being painful, in addition to my skin first turning yellow, and later it got so bad it turned orange, the worst part of it was I developed a terrible itch all over. It's due to the fact that I had the cancer, and it affected my liver, and the bilirubin wouldn't drain out. But I had a terrible itching all over. There's no part of me that didn't itch. I was taking Benadryl. I took it so often, I got to the point where I was taking it every 2 hours. It's bad enough when you have to take it at the regular intervals and the regular dosage. And I got to where my scalp itched so bad that Janet actually rubbed liquid Benadryl into my scalp. And even when I dozed off, when I did sleep, I think I scratched a lot in my sleep. I dug my toenails into my legs. Whew, that's another story. But anyway, the Benadryl did cause a little bit of what I call a brain fog. I was there, my body was there, but lots of times my mind was so messed up from all the drugs, all the Benadryl, that I didn't really have the power of concentration anymore. I wouldn't have dared to drive a car. If something terrible would have happened from that, I'm sure. But thanks to one of my children, thanks to my daughter, Jenny, over here with the little one, and my son-in-law, Maurice, over here, they guided me to Johns Hopkins up in Baltimore. I consulted with at least four other hospitals to try to get treatment. And it just wasn't good what they wanted me to do. I was suffering pretty bad, so we ended up at Johns Hopkins. And that turned out to be such a blessing because they do specialize in the sort of cancer that I had. And one thing I found out once I got up there is no matter how bad you think you've got it, somebody's always got it worse. You know, I was up there all feeling sorry for myself. But I looked around. I saw people, I saw little kids in wheelchairs, skinny, no hair, all this stuff hooked up to them. That's enough to tear you up. It's bad enough for an adult, but when it happens to children, oh, I tell you, that's another story. Before I went in for my operation, which is October the 3rd of last year, my system was messed up anyway, and the doctor said, well, I don't want you to eat anything. All you can have is Jell-O. So by the time this ordeal was over with, you know, it's probably not too much nutrition in Jell-O. I tried every flavor there was. I had a lot of good Jell-Os, but after a while, that got pretty old. The worst kind was the lemon, or the lime Jell-O. I hope I never have to see that again. But My weight got down to 145 because I lived off of Jell-O for a while. Got real skinny. And I remember how happy I was the day that the doctor told me I could try some soup, see how that did. So this was about maybe the fourth day after the operation. I was still in the hospital. So they brought the menu in from the cafeteria, said, look here, there's got some soups listed. So my eyes lit up when I saw that they had potato soup. So I said, man, I got to have some of that. I had in mind the kind of soup that my mom used to make. Best potato soup ever. Janet makes a real good potato soup too, by the way. So I was laying up in the bed, and in comes somebody carrying the little tray of food with the potato soup. I opened the lid up. Yeah, it looked pretty good. Wasn't like Mama's. I took a bite of it. I said, this is definitely not Mama's potato soup. You know, you hear a lot of bad stuff about hospital food. But anyway, I was so glad. I was so glad to get it. It was a lot better than Jell-O. Y'all got to not let me go too long here. I know we need to get out of here, but bear with me just a little bit. I'll try to speed it up. Okay, so some of the lessons that I want to talk to you about, some of you probably already know them. Some of these I knew, some of them I relearned. The first one, like I say, is come closer to God and God will come closer to you. Just don't forget that. He's not hard to find. He's right here among us. All you got to do is, if you don't know him, and invite him into your life. And the power of prayer. I tell you, I can't tell you the number of people, and the number of groups of people that told me they were praying for me. And that has just meant so much to me. I mean, I got... And the cards I got, I tell you, probably the number of cards probably is in the hundreds. I got cards from people that I didn't even know. And I'd ask Janet about it. She'd say, oh, yeah, I think they go to such and such church. But people from all around, even from other states, prayed for me. And if I didn't mention it, some of my family's up front here today. One of my brothers and both my sisters are here today, and I know that they said that their churches were praying for me also, and that really does mean a lot, and that's one of the things that really got me through this. And not just the prayers, but the church family itself. I can't imagine being around a better group of Christians. Guy Linda Sutphen, guy went with me several times to Baltimore, and when I went up for the operation, he and his wife went with us, stayed a couple days. They stayed until the operation was over with. Then they came back home because it cost a lot of money to leave a car parked up there. That's one of the disadvantages of living in a city. Even if you stay in a motel, you could pay to park your car. So they waited until the operation was over. I hated to do it to them. It was a 9-hour operation, but they stayed until I came out of that. Then they came back to pick us up in a couple weeks when it was time for me to leave. And George Hamm, I saw him earlier. I don't know if he's still here or not. There he is on the back row. George, bless his heart, came over and cut my grass the rest of the year. And other people, they made it clear to me that they'd help if I needed them. And I have no doubt that they would have. I just tried to not call on people any more than I had to. But I do appreciate the church family, and the church gave us some money. Some of the Sunday school classes gave money. The circle gave money. Various individuals. Every once in a while, somebody come up, stick some wad of money in my pocket. I look at it later, it'd be $50. Somebody gave me a $100 gas card. It takes about $100 worth of gas to go up there and back. It's about a 700-mile round trip. And people would send cards, put $10, $20 in them, say, here, get you something to eat while you're up there. And I just can't tell you how much that meant to us. Now, I'm going to strive to do the same thing for other people, especially if they have to go out of town for treatments like this. It does cost a lot of money, and I'm going to strive to send cards and maybe put $5, $10, maybe $20 in it to help them out. So I do appreciate that. Another lesson I've learned that's sort of similar to this is little things mean a lot. The weekend after my operation, I think it might have been on a Wednesday, four of the five children in our family came up. A couple of the spouses came, and my little grandson, Finley, is 2.5 now. Well, he wasn't that old then, but they came to see me, and it was such a joy to see family. I told them not to come. I said, that's too far. I can't picture you driving in the city, but somehow they got there. And when they came, they brought this big cardboard box, probably this long, probably this tall, probably that wide. And they came in and said, well, here's something from a church. I said, what in the world could that be? I had no idea. So I think it was the same day that they brought this box that I was released from intensive care to go to a regular room. And we had to wait around till 9 or 10 o'clock that night to get moved for some reason. And I said, well, let's go ahead and open that box. So we opened it up. It was full of balloons, not balloons blown up real big. I mean, it was a lot of them in that box. It was a pretty good sized box. They were probably blown up to about this size, and they all had messages in them. I think Angie Denton probably had something to do with that. But anyway, it had little messages. A lot of them were from kids. A lot of them were from adults. Some people just put their names. But most of them wrote a little message of encouragement. And myself, Janet, and all the family was there. I tell you, first we'd laugh, then we'd cry. Then we'd laugh, then we'd cry some more. It was just such a blessing to get something like that. And if I hadn't thanked you before, I thank you now. And you're probably familiar with Lisa Crowdy sitting back in here somewhere. I've done pictures of her little dancer probably for 12 or 15 years, something like that. And over the years, I've got to where I know those kids pretty well. On several different occasions, those kids made get-well cards for me. I mean, they weren't just something written on a piece of paper or a card that somebody bought. They made them by hand. And one of the cards from each of these persons, I'm not sure how many dancers you have. You have 50 or 75? Or okay. That seemed like a lot more than that. But they sent these messages several times. On one of them, they put lipstick on and put a kiss on a piece of paper and wrote a little message and sent it to me. One time they had put a Band-Aid and wrote a little message under it, get well and all that. And I knew most of them by name, and I just can't tell you, Lisa, how much that meant to me. And I thank you. The night before I left to go for my operation, my brother in Christ, Brian Wolford, up in the balcony, came by with his little daughter, Holly. They said a prayer for me. And I can't tell you how much that meant to me. It was just great. And several people, I'd never heard of this before, but several people prayed with me over the phone. I would have never thought to do that, but I think it meant the same. And I do appreciate that. Now, one lesson I did learn is when you go through an adversity, like I say, in my case, cancer, for some reason it made me a little bit bolder. I used to worry more about what people thought and what their reaction would be. But I think when you get to a point like that, you say, well, you know, what's the worst that can happen? Can it be any worse than what I'm experiencing already? So I just have a hard time going out and trying to talk to somebody about the Lord. I mean, it just doesn't come natural for some people. But that's one of the pleasant effects of what happened to me, is that it has made me bolder. I think the night before I left the hospital, a man checked in down the hallway, his family in there with him. He was real apprehensive about this operation. And it's understandable because, I mean, he was going to go through the same thing I was. I mean, they cut you open, take a lot of parts out, then they put it all back together. I heard somebody say they use super glue. I don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, one of his daughters kept trying to reassure him. He said, Dad, it's going to be okay. Then I got to talking to him, and she pointed to me and said, Dad, look at there. He just had this operation 8 days ago. Look how well he's doing. So it inspired me to go in and talk with this gentleman and to pray with him. Now, it was hard for me to believe that I was doing that, but I did go in and pray with him, and I tell you, it really gave me a good feeling. And after that, I said, you know, this feels pretty good. I think I'll try it again. So over the course of the time we've gone back up there, believe it or not, I've done that several more times. And usually when I do that, I have a cross to give to them. When I became a deacon in 97, one of my fellow deacons gave me a little cross like this. So I try to have one of these with me so that I can pass it along to someone, especially someone who I think might not know the Lord and needs some type of reminder. But anyway, I do think something like this, for some reason, it gives you courage, and you sort of think, well, what have I got to lose? Why not? So maybe you don't need adversity to make you do that. I hope not. But we all need to do what we can to spread the good news of Jesus. And I do want to thank my family, especially Janet, because when I was suffering, I know the whole family suffered with me. I know she suffered with me, as well as the rest of the family. And it really upsets the apple cart, as they used to say. You know, it disrupts your plans. I know that she had to put up with a lot for me. She did try to encourage me to eat, being the good cook that she is. She gave me a lot of variety. Lots of times I'd be looking through a magazine, I'd see something I liked. I said, Janet, look at that. Doesn't that look good? Maybe we ought to try that sometime. Usually the next day, there it was. But you all know what a good cook she is anyway. The last important lesson I have is this. Well, it might not be the last one. Lots of families don't come around and say, well, I love you, all this kind of stuff. In my family, when I was a kid, I don't really remember anybody saying that except maybe my mother once in a while. The rest of us, it was understood, but people just have a... People, I think, back then didn't say it as much. But it really... My advice is, if you love somebody, tell them that you love them. All this, I think I've said it to everybody in my family. I had never said it to my brother that's the next in age younger than I am, if nothing else, all this I went through was worth it because it gave me the courage to tell him that I loved him. And he told me he loved me too. So if nothing else good came out of this, that one thing made it all worthwhile. So before I close, I just want to say this. If you're having trouble, turn to the Lord. If you don't know him, get to know him as soon as you can. Because if you put it off, you might wait too late, and we don't want that to happen. I hope and pray that I see everybody here in heaven at some point in time. Yeah, there's a lot more I was going to say, but it's already after 12 o'clock, so I better call it quits at that. In a minute, we're going to have the hymn of invitation. If there's anyone here who has accepted the Lord but hasn't made it public, we'll just come on up to the front, and Robert Blankenship, the chairman of the deacons, will be up here with me. You can come up and let us know about it. We'll pray with you. If you want to become a member of this church, in any way that we accept members, just come on up. We'll chat with you for a minute and pray with you. Is there anything else you want to say? All right. Well, thank you for being here. This has probably been a little bit of an unusual sermon, but like I say, the Lord told me to come, and if he tells you to do it, you better listen.